Okay, we're back with Chris Caulfield, who was a PhD student at RPI studying the opioid polydrug crisis. We've already gotten into some of the barriers to access, the class, race, and gender problems that are contributing to this crisis. So, Chris, what is the aim of your research?
My research aims to improve public health outcomes around drug treatment services. So I interview clinicians and other professionals about how stigma and shame enter into clinical care or through insurance regulations or through legal affairs. So my work examines how social and cultural factors impact health outcomes in drug treatment.
And how does stigma create a barrier to access?
Good question. So stigma can be viewed as a socially produced relational, a socially produced relation where a person who is stigmatized is marked out as being somehow deficient or worthy of public shame or pushed away from the community. And stigma has been one of the tough nuts of drug treatment for decades. It's often been said that shame kills, stigma kills, silence kills. If a person feels ashamed of his or her or their drug use, then that person may very well hide that use from everyone, from family, from friends, and from their practitioner. And so if the people around them don't know about the use, that can make addressing the use, obviously, way tougher.
Let's talk about your methodology. How do you even go about measuring the extent to which stigma prevents people from seeking services?
Good question. So my methodology is unstructured or semi-structured qualitative interviews. So I'm interviewing clinicians, I'm interviewing public health researchers, law enforcement, policymakers, and I'm talking with them about how their personal experiences, how have they seen stigma enter into the interactions between patients and people who need care. And so I'm not measuring things quantitatively. I'm trying to get stories in order to kind of round out the quantitative work that's already being done very well by many. So yeah, that's it.
What do they say? What are some of the anecdotes that you've gotten?
So the anecdotes run the gamut. I mean, some of the clinicians that I've interviewed have told me stories about other clinicians who described patients in language that is definitely stigmatizing. For example, one psychiatrist works at a major urban hospital, and she works in a unit that treats women who are pregnant and postpartum and seeking and have a use issue, substance use disorder. So she told me a story about OBGYN, obstetrics gynecology physician, who she was working with on a patient. And so my informant told me that the OBGYN was talking about this patient, and the informant said, "Well, I want to thank you for your good work because this patient is doing well. She's come a long way." And the OBGYN looked at her with kind of disgust, and she said, "But she wouldn't let me tie her tubes," as in her fallopian tubes, as in for permanent or semi-permanent contraceptive. So this is the kind of way that stigma is talked about by some clinicians. The The decision to tie one's fallopian tubes is obviously a major life decision. And so this OBGYN was really expressing a patronizing, paternalistic view that is unethical from a clinician's standpoint. It's not in conformity with patient autonomy, with respect for patient autonomy. It's the woman's decision whether or not she wants to tie her tubes. Another clinician told me that on one of her days in the job, she overheard a senior level provider who referred to a patient as an asshole junkie on the phone, to probably a private conversation. I interviewed a police officer who also related that many of his colleagues, fellow police officers, refer to patients in a deeply stigmatizing way, like a junkie, a drug abuser. So those are some of the ways that stigmatized attitudes are expressed, or that they're noticed by my informants.
So obviously language is very important to this stigma problem. Mm. What are some ways that we can talk about substance use disorders without stigmatizing people?
Good question. So you just mentioned one in your question. Instead of talking about addiction, which I've been using because it's part of the nomenclature, we can talk about substance use disorder, or better yet, perhaps, chaotic use. So the words that we use are important. And so I mentioned already drug abuse. Well, abuse is carries a certain connotation of oftentimes associated with violence. And so using that word drug abuse can subtly change the tenor of the conversation. And so refraining from using that kind of language can help us, I think, and I'm not alone in saying this, can help us to develop ways of relating to drug users that are more compassionate.
Do you find that class, race, and gender stigmas are compounding with this problem, given that treatment tends to be gendered, tends to have a race factor?
Absolutely. So going back to the issue of women who use drugs while pregnant or postpartum, in 25 states, if memory serves me, there are laws on the books that criminalize a woman who tests positive for drugs upon giving birth, illicit drugs. And what does that do? That does several things. It drives those women to not tell their providers that they're using drugs. And so the providers can't possibly provide those women with substance use disorder treatment while they're pregnant or postpartum. It drives women to, in some cases, refuse to even tell providers that they're pregnant, because they don't want, if they're picked up on a drug charge, because they don't want to face increased incarceration or perhaps separation from their forthcoming child. It also pushes women who are postpartum to refuse to disclose their drug use to clinicians, because they, again, don't want to face incarceration. Of course they don't. So the postpartum period is one of the deadliest periods for drug users, because after they've given birth, in many cases, they stop use during pregnancy. And then after birth, postpartum period, lots of stressors, they may begin using again, but their tolerance has reduced because they haven't been using. So the drug becomes much more deadly, for example, opioids or heroin. So the postpartum period is an extremely difficult and potentially deadly period for these women, and they need help, not incarceration. So that's one way that gender intersects with addiction treatment.
So this has been part two of our interview with Chris Caulfield, and we're going to come back with part three next time. For Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.